Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Big breaking news in Boston today as another city councilor enters the mayor's race and the city loses its police commissioner. News just this morning that Boston Police Commissioner William Gross is stepping down and retiring as of tomorrow. Superintendent Dennis White will take his place. So for more on the news, we are joined by Bill Forey, who is editor and publisher of the Dorchester Reporter. Bill, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks. Great to be back. How are you?
Oh, great. Thanks. Thanks for asking. So let's jump right in. A retirement announcement with 24 hours notice. Yeah. Are you surprised?
I am. I kind of yelped in the newsroom today when we heard this news. We were, of course, we've been covering a lot of breaking news lately on the political front, including, as you mentioned, Councilor Asabi George's announcement this morning that she's joining the mayor's race. And boom, out of nowhere in this email from the mayor's office comes this this news about Commissioner Gross. And, you know, candidly, Commissioner Gross has been in the news lately as a potential candidate for mayor. And so there has been this anticipation that there could be a move in his near future into the political realm. But this was a surprise, especially that that he will be leaving as of tomorrow and replaced, as you mentioned, by Superintendent Dennis White.
So multiple sources today saying that, I think everyone's first guess was, oh, well, this is in preparation for running for mayor. Multiple sources saying it doesn't look like it. What are you hearing?
That's what I'm hearing, that in fact, Commissioner Gross will not be a candidate for mayor. We have not talked to Commissioner Gross yet personally, but we do have several sources in City Hall, high place sources, that tell us, in fact, he has made a decision not to run. We don't know yet what is next for Commissioner Gross. He is retiring from the BPD, and what's next is not clear yet. He has been, as I mentioned, bandied about, and he himself had said just a couple of weeks ago that he was as much as 95% in as running for mayor. So there has been a shift here, and whether it's another appointment in public service or in private sector, just not clear yet. But he's been on the Boston Police Department for 37 years, highly respected, very well liked, both by rank and file within the BPD, and frankly by the public at large. His Facebook page has been lit up for weeks now with people really encouraging, urging him to run for mayor of Boston. A caveat there that many of those people who are his closest fans don't necessarily live in the city of Boston, but he's popular in the neighborhoods as well. He was a beat cop here in Dorchester at the beginning of his career, grew up in this neighborhood in Dorchester and Roxbury, and is really a son of Boston, even though he was born in Maryland. He was reared here in the city, understands these streets very, very well, and is a popular figure across the board here in the city.
So, Bill, is it I'm spending more time with my family? Just briefly, what is he saying is the reason for the retirement?
We haven't heard from him yet today, other than the statement that was released by the city of Boston, by the mayor's office. He said after long and careful consideration, he's decided to make the decision to retire from this role. He doesn't say anything about what's next, other than to say, there's a next chapter coming, of course. So we will all be eager to hear from the commissioner directly on what's next for him.
And Boston Police Superintendent Dennis White takes over as the next commissioner. He served on the Police Reform Task Force for the city. So what do you expect from him and the direction of the BPD?
I expect to see a steady hand here on the wheel. Dennis White has been Commissioner Gross's chief of staff. He's a superintendent within the BPD. And I think I read this move as happening because, Mayor Walsh is leaving. We don't know exactly when, probably in the next couple of weeks, frankly. He could be, with the speed of what's going on in Washington right now, on confirmation for Biden cabinet nominees. Mayor Walsh very, very well could be no longer Mayor Walsh by like Valentine's Day. So I think part of this move could be knowing that Commissioner Gross was going to leave this year to seek to fill this position with an appointment that Mayor Walsh can make. And that's what he's done today, is change the guard at the BPD.
Well, there is a lot to keep watching there. We'll continue to cover it. Bill Forey, editor and publisher of the Dorchester Reporter. Bill, hey, thanks. Appreciate you taking the time.
You're welcome. Thanks so much.
Okay, from Boston Police Quarters headquarters to City Hall. As we mentioned, the other major story breaking today, Boston City Councilor Anissa Asaibi George has officially entered the race for mayor. That means she joins Boston City Councilors Andrea Campbell and Michelle Wu in the race. We're actually going to hear from both Campbell and Wu a little later in the show on some specific policy proposals. But on the day that they each declared, they joined us here on Radio Boston to talk about their candidacies, and Anissa Asaibi George accepted our invitation to do the same. So we caught up with Councilor Asaibi George earlier in the afternoon. I started by asking her why she decided to run and what she believes she brings to the race.
Well, first of all, thank you very much again for having me on and giving me an opportunity to talk about my desire to lead this city and the work that I think I'll bring to the table, that I know I'll bring to the table based on my life experience. You know, Boston is my home, and I obviously have very deep roots here, and that connection drives me to work hard every single day as an at-large city councilor. And as a mayor, I know that I will be able to bring that same drive and desire to serve to that role.
You just mentioned you're an at-large city councilor, which means you've needed to appeal to a wide swath of the city. In announcing your candidacy, the Globe, Boston Globe, characterized you as, quote, something of a centrist on a political body that has become increasingly progressive in recent years, end quote. Do you agree with that assessment? Is that right?
Well, I've always described myself as a lowercase p progressive. It's really important to think big and to hope, but it's also equally important to exist in reality and to understand that there are challenges that our families are facing every single day, that our kids are dealing with in our school system. When we think about the work that is left undone, we need to take that practical, realist approach to the work of the city. And that's what I've brought to the table. I was a teacher for 13 years. I've built a small business in this city. And to do those things, you have to approach the work from a very realistic perspective.
You made your announcement today outside East Boston High School. You just referenced the fact that you were a teacher for 13 years. Certainly, the Boston Public Schools is a huge part of this sort of oversight and supervision of the mayor of Boston. And it's been a tough year with COVID-19, especially in relations between the city, the superintendent, and teachers. What do you think you bring to the table as a former teacher that would be unique in the mayor's office?
No, certainly no teacher has ever served in the mayor's office as mayor of this city, and no teacher has ever led this city. And I certainly look forward to using every moment of those 13 years in the classroom to inform my work, especially as it relates to education. And when I think about both my experience as a student myself, as a parent of four BPS students, and as a former teacher, those experiences right now as an at-large counselor and as chair of the council's committee on education inform that work every single day. But I think about the experiences for sure of the kids that were in my care, that were in my classroom all of those years. And those experiences taught me about the true housing insecurity that they experienced, the homelessness that they experience, the food insecurity, and their families struggle with that. And that continues today. That hasn't changed. We have so much work to do as a city to support those kids and their families. And I learned all of that, not just through my own personal experiences, but through the experiences of my kids.
You know, the work of the city is wide-ranging. Law enforcement is a piece of that. You're not the only breaking news today. The other big breaking news in the city of Boston is Boston Police Commissioner William Gross is retiring as of tomorrow. Superintendent Dennis White will become the new commissioner. And multiple sources are saying, unlike earlier speculation, that Gross is, while retiring, not running for mayor. So what is your reaction to this news, and what does the BPD need to be thinking about as it goes through a leadership transition while the city's going through transition?
Well, first, I want to congratulate Commissioner Gross on his many, many years of service to this great city. He has served certainly with distinction and has, you know, made history himself as the first African-American, the first Black commissioner of this city. And I want to wish him well in his retirement. Commissioner Gross and I share a little bit in common. We both graduated from the same high school, Boston Tech, although a few years apart from one another, and I'm proud of his service to the city and want to wish him well. I want to note the question around law enforcement and policing and the Boston Police Department and the city reminds me how important it is for a mayor to be involved in many discussions. I, of course, sort of own the space when we talk about our schools and education, but being mayor of the city of Boston means you need to lead in all issues. So it's the economy, it's the climate, it's transportation, and it is in policing. And we have a lot of work to do to make sure that we're doing the things we need to do to make sure they have tools at their resource to do the work that they need to do. But we're also doing other things, like my work around our best clinicians, to make sure that we have social workers that are on hand to respond to the mental health crises that too many of our residents are experiencing day in and day out. So I'm proud of my record on that, on making sure that we have those investments in mental health professionals. But it is about that bigger picture. It's about doing all of the things we need to do to make sure that Boston can be the great city that we know it to be.
A moment ago, you referred to the historic nature of Commissioner Gross's service. You're the third candidate in this race, but you are the third candidate who is a woman, the third candidate who is a woman of color. All the candidates represent a kind of diversity that has previously been unheard of in a Boston mayor's race. What does that diversity mean for you, to you, and for the city of Boston this year?
Well, I'll tell you, it's actually very special and very personal for me. My dad is an Arab, and when I was young and had an interest in municipal government and an interest in perhaps running for office someday, he very directly said to me, in this city, with a girl like you and an Arab name, Anissa Rasaibi, you will not be able to be elected to anything. Mm. And as an at-large city councilor, I proved him wrong, as any oldest daughter of an Arab would want to do. But I'm very proud of the work that I've accomplished. And, you know, I'm very proud of my history and my heritage and my name. And I'm excited to work to lead this city and to be elected to lead this city as its next mayor.
Councillor Sivey George, I'm asking all the candidates this today. There's a move for a home rule petition to forego a special election if current Mayor Marty Walsh resigns his post due to his confirmation before March 5th. What's your position on that home rule petition?
So I'm not taking a position on that. I think that it's certainly questionable at the least, but very likely unethical for me to take a position on that home rule petition, as it very directly does impact me and my campaign strategy and the work that's ahead of us. I'm in it, whether there's a special and a regular election cycle or just a regular election cycle. I do think it's inappropriate for anyone either announced as a candidate for mayor or seriously looking at this race to be involved in both the discussion and the vote.
And give us a sneak preview. You've entered the race now. What should we anticipate as the big policy issues for Boston you're going to try to lead on during this race?
Well, there are issues I've already led on. It's our schools. It's our economy. It's those that are experiencing homelessness and the opioid crisis, working with our residents who are vulnerable, making sure that our schools are able to open the doors quickly for our students and that we're able to you know, catch our kids up on the academics that they've lost, to make sure that our residents have access to mental health services. It is the work that I've been doing on the council over the last 5 years that I will continue to lead on as mayor of this city.
And that is Boston City Councilor Anissa Asaibi George, who announced today her candidacy for mayor of Boston. Councilor Asaibi George, thanks so much for your time. Hope we'll talk to you again soon.
Very good. Thank you.
Two other Boston City councilors, Andrea Campbell and Michelle Wu, were already in the race, and they recently came out with significant public health initiatives. They're both joining us today to talk about those proposals. We will begin with Andrea Campbell, who rolled out a vaccine plan in December and now is addressing the public health crisis at Massachusetts Avenue and Malnia Cass Boulevard. We spoke with Campbell late this morning and started with her reaction to news that had just then broken about Boston Police Commissioner William Gross's retirement.
Well, obviously, it was a surprise to me, but of course, it's a personal decision by Commissioner Gross, and I congratulate him on his retirement and, of course, look forward to working with the acting commissioner because there are, of course, pressing issues with respect to policing reform. And I think it's also an opportunity to begin to reflect on how we create greater diversity still in the leadership roles in the department, particularly at the senior level.
I'd like to turn now to your candidacy for mayor. The last time we spoke with you was actually the day you announced. So now you have started rolling out key policy initiatives. You have talked about vaccines and vaccine equity. Now the public health crisis that's embodied at the intersection of Mass Ave and Millennia Cast Boulevard, which is centered around addiction and homelessness. It is the number two thing in your policy list on your campaign webpage. Why emphasize so heavily this particular policy issue for the city?
Well, this is in addition to COVID-19, Mass and Cass is another major public health crisis. I put out this plan because I wanted folks to recognize that I understand the urgency and that we needed not only a plan, but action. This neighborhood is also near and dear to me. I grew up right down the street, and it is quite sad to see what our children are encountering, whether it's needles in the parks, bottle caps. So folks on the ground are working incredibly hard. But what is most important is that we have a plan. And as mayor, I have a plan, but also specific things that we can do to improve our outreach in the area.
I'd like to stay on that plan for a minute. There's several key components, just a few. Appointing a Mass and Cass chief who would report directly to the mayor, decentralizing services from this really highly concentrated area, moving quickly to roll out ferry service to the Long Island facilities that have been dormant since 2014. Mayor Walsh, the current mayor, has proposed decentralizing services, has had a task force on the area. Does this plan suggest that Mayor Walsh has been ineffective in addressing the crisis at Mass and Cass? And where do you think you'll be able to get traction and solutions that he has not been able to accomplish?
So first, I want to acknowledge there are a whole host of folks, including city employees and local providers and residents who have been working incredibly hard, but they're overwhelmed. And so I put out this plan and said, you know, one, as mayor, I would appoint a Mass and Cass chief whose sole responsibility it is, and that this Mass and Cass chief be a public health professional. It was also critically important to me that we develop and create a first responder unit that not only includes first responders, but includes mental health clinicians, as well as public health and other professionals, and to also be consistent in our response. Decentralization, also another critical piece of the plan, and the plan is to decentralize services so these services are more accessible, and to also provide more safe spaces and shelter and supportive housing, which we can absolutely do. And of course, reactivate the Long Island conversation with a more realistic plan.
This is a regional problem that is having a very hyper-local manifestation. That means that making these changes requires resources on residents who are coming into the city but are not from the city, collaboration with communities like Quincy, other neighborhoods in Boston. It's not been clear that there's been the will from other parts of the city and the region to take this issue on. How do you get that traction and that collaboration to scale up this response and decentralize it the way you want to?
So before launching this campaign, I did a walkthrough with residents and spoke with many who were helping with response down there. Immediately after that walkthrough with not only residents, but those who were actually experiencing substance use disorder who participated in that walkthrough, I sent a letter to the mayor and the governor outlining strategies for a more effective response. And I sent it to the governor and folks at the state because there is no way the city of Boston can be effective in its response without further involvement from the state and from the region. And so I'll continue to push that. That absolutely is a part of my plan as well.
In our remaining time, let's talk for a minute about your vaccine plan. You've been focusing on this since December. We face this challenge, which is there are a lot of investments that need to be made. There's clearly condemnation at the state level, and you lay out some pretty serious call to action at the city level around ensuring equitable access to vaccines, long-term sustainable access. But this horse is also already out of the gate. Vaccinations started in December. How do you manage the push to increase translation services in foreign language, get more sites stood up in the city while this plane is also flying?
Absolutely. You know, equity in our COVID-19 response is critically important. And I introduced actually a hearing order on this very issue in December of last year, and saying that the city of Boston needs to get ahead, make sure we have access to testing and greater access, particularly in communities of color, to testing, but also when it comes to the vaccine. I have a hearing that's actually coming up on February 9th and saying that we have to have a multilingual, culturally competent response. And that not only means that we have locations in every neighborhood but also that we are having robust communication and outreach and delivering information to our hardest to reach populations, and that we're investing in organizations on the ground. And I've been at the forefront of this starting in December and will continue to, because it is critically important to us getting out of the pandemic, but also to our economic recovery.
So I recognize you have this hearing on the 9th that you organized with Councillor Arroyo. Also, you know, I think we're all aware that every minute right now, the clock is ticking. Somebody else could get sick and some percentage of those people could die before vaccines happen. What's the push today, tomorrow, next Monday as phase two begins to improve immediately the access for people of color and other vulnerable populations in Boston?
It is immediately opening up more vaccine and vaccination sites, which is happening, but we need to do that swifter and quickly. It is also very important at the same time that we immediately invest in community-based organizations. And so I will continue to push for that to happen and not let up.
Briefly, before we let you go, Boston City Councilor at Large Anissa Saibi George entered the race alongside you and Councilor Michelle Wu today. Reactions to that announcement?
Of course, I congratulated my council colleague and will continue to work in partnership. You know, I got back into this race back in September when the mayor was still in it. And for me, it wasn't about who was in the seat or who was going to run. It was about looking at the moment in time we're in and saying Boston has a unique opportunity to address our own painful history with race and racism and the persistent inequities that exist in the city of Boston, and that I have the unique leadership, not only because I understand those inequities, I have lived them. And obviously, you know, the reason I got into public service work is after losing my twin brother, who passed away while in the custody of the Department of Correction, and asking that question, how do two twins born and raised in this city have such different life outcomes? That is my work ahead, to reach as many voters as possible, to get our message out there. And I will tell you, we are feeling tremendous momentum. We just had an endorsement from First Lady Diane Patrick yesterday, and we're going to continue to work really hard in making sure that we reach every voter across the city of Boston and make them a part of this campaign.
And last question for you, Councillor Campbell, and I'm asking you, Councillor Saibi George and Councillor Wu, the same question today. The question of the home rule petition, which would bypass a special election that's required if Mayor Walsh is confirmed as Labor Secretary and resigns his position by March 5th. Where do you stand on that home rule petition?
I support the home rule petition and not requiring folks to show up in the midst of a pandemic to four elections in the course of this year.
And that is Andrea Campbell, city councilor and a candidate for mayor in the city of Boston. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
So let's turn now to Boston City Councilor Michelle Wu, the first of the candidates to enter the Boston mayoral race. Councilor Wu also has been calling for action around equitable access to the coronavirus vaccine. She joins us now live. Councilor Wu, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Great to be with you, Tiziana.
So I do want to get to your plans and what you're calling for around the vaccine, but I think I will start by asking you the same question I asked Councillor Campbell first, which is just your reactions to the surprising news today. The Boston Police Department Commissioner William Gross is retiring effective tomorrow.
Yes, clearly every day is a big news day in Boston in yes. 2021. It is, you know, after 3 decades of serving the city, Commissioner Gross has certainly overseen a huge part of Boston's growth and the public safety aspect that fits into that. And so I wish him well and a fulfilling retirement. And it also underscores the chance and the moment we're in right now to really reimagine our systems and think through how all of these pieces from our public safety, public health, our economic recovery truly fit together in this new chapter for Boston.
All right, Councillor Wu, let's talk about vaccinations. Certainly they are front of mind and certainly have been in the last 48 hours. It's been a frustrating rollout, especially recently. You have proposed as one way to alleviate that, a plan that would set up vaccination sites in each of Boston's zip codes, create a single online interface for residents to be able to view appointments in the city, create an online volunteer portal for those who want to help at vaccination sites, and require weekly reporting on demographic and staff data. That's a lot, and it's focused on equity. Why these initiatives, and how do you think they would help solve the problems we're experiencing right now with the rollout?
You know, among so many urgent issues facing the city today, the pandemic truly makes each one worse and more dangerous. And so the most direct way to save lives and the most immediate action is to end the pandemic by getting our residents the protection of this COVID-19 vaccine. And we've seen the pandemic exacerbate every inequity and injustice facing communities in Boston, especially our Black and Latinx and immigrant residents. And so in this very last phase of that pandemic, rolling out the vaccines, we can't leave it to chance. We've already seen what has been happening, a delayed process. Massachusetts is 29th in the country in terms of getting our vaccines out to our residents, and the stark inequities in terms of how close residents of color live to vaccination sites compared to white residents in Massachusetts. This is something that we need to step in and put proactive parameters around to guarantee accessibility and equity.
You know, we started the week with Dr. Anthony Fauci this week, and today we're talking to you, a Boston City Councilor, so from the federal level to the local level. And this is kind of a vertical integration challenge. So some of what you're talking about would rely on things to happen at the state level that aren't happening. So how are you certain that what you're proposing is actually doable when some of the inputs, at least, are out of control of the city?
That's right. And I think, in fact, this is the challenge to deliver progress and actually implement policies across so many areas at the local level, whether it is transportation, where the state plays a big role, or housing, or climate. And so in this very, very urgent issue, it is true that the state controls a big piece of it, but the city ultimately covers that last bit that touches people's lives, setting up the vaccination sites, ensuring that they are connected and that outreach and that that residents' needs, our constituents are able to access them. And so even though we're waiting for the state to connect with the federal government and get more doses and to roll out the unused doses that are actually still sitting in Massachusetts, we need to be preparing now for when we get to phase two and phase three, for access to the general public. If we wait until then, when everybody is eligible, to then finally decide where we're going to put these sites and how to staff them and what the hours will be, that will be too late and there will be even more delay. So now's the time, in parallel, to have the conversations and to plan out all of these logistics.
So just standing up a site in a particular location, is that something that can be essentially done standalone by the city? And if so, where do the resources come from for one in every zip code?
You know, this is part of the larger conversation. Right now, the state is driving these efforts, but we need to get to the point where there's no question when and how and where residents from every community will be able to access this life-saving protection. And so there are ongoing conversations about how we ensure that the prioritization happens, but this cannot be a Hunger Games situation where we are drawing things out and hoping that some group can get in before another group. We need to speed up everything and ensure that there are no excuses, that the city is doing all we can to get our residents vaccinated, to build trust for this vaccine. And that involves showing that we are planning out in a way that is transparent, that is moving quickly, and is accessible to everyone.
I think you heard us just now speaking with Boston City Councilor Andrea Campbell. We talked to her earlier this morning. She's also proposing a COVID-19 recovery and vaccine plan. In a competitive race, candidates have to differentiate themselves. That's actually good for democracy to have that competition. But we're also in this moment where it's an all-hands-on-deck emergency. So how do the people of Boston, the people in this race, have a good race, but coordinate on key things that are essential as this pandemic unfolds right now?
Now is the time for all hands on deck. We need to make sure that we are not just putting in place the right policies, but also creating the mechanisms for residents to be shaping and driving these policies. So that is really the place where city government comes in. We are the level that's closest to the people. And so I know my colleagues in city government, you know, some of us are wearing multiple hats these days as a city councilor and also as a mayoral candidate, and the chance to propose a vision, not just for the immediate relief and the steps we need to take to end this pandemic, but to build a recovery that is lasting, that is sustainable, that is resilient, and that is equitable. And so I think we're all coming at it from slightly different bits of lived experience and priorities, but we're all moving in the same direction, which is ensuring that Boston residents are protected as quickly as possible and that we are recovering from this pandemic in a way that builds a brighter city for everyone.
There are three Boston City Councilors in the race now, so I just want to give you an opportunity to react to the news today of Boston City Councilor Anissa Saibi George's entrance as another candidate.
Yes, I've tremendous respect for my colleague, for both of my colleagues, but exciting to see the news of our race growing a little bit bigger. And I know this is going to be an important, thrilling year for the city of Boston. This moment is incredibly significant. We are still battling multiple interconnected crises, and we have the chance over the next year to weigh all different directions for the city, ideas, and most of all, to continue building a vision for our future that everybody can be part of. And so I'm looking forward to continuing that. We've been in this for several months now. We launched this campaign months ago because our goal is to listen, to lift up the stories of residents in every single neighborhood. And it's been a joy and a privilege to be able to have so many conversations and see the momentum for change in our city.
And Councillor Wu, last question for you, which I asked both the other city councillors today too. Where do you stand on the home rule petition to bypass a special election if Mayor Walsh is confirmed as Labor Secretary and resigns before March 5th?
For me, this has been clear from the beginning. We are in a pandemic, and the costs and the public health risks of administering a whole separate election does not make sense for this year. So I support the home rule petition.
And that is Boston City Councilor Michelle Wu. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All right. When was the last time you actually hung out or connected with your friends? I know we are in the midst of a global pandemic that makes in-person hangouts, basically outside your immediate bubble, pretty much impossible. But even without a pandemic, the Boston Globe's Billy Baker found it harder and harder to stay connected to his closest buds. At 40, his editor assigned him to, quote, write about how middle-aged men have no friends, end quote, after some pretty funny soul-searching about why his editor assigned him that story. Billy Baker took a journey to find out why this happens and to reconnect with his own friends. And he writes about it in his new memoir, We Need to Hang Out. He is here to talk about it, and we want you to hang out with us and talk about it. How have you stayed connected with your pals over the years? How about during the pandemic? If you're a certain age, like me, has it been your experience that life just gets in the way of friendship? Call us. Share your experiences. 800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. Billy Baker, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So I really got a kick out of the beginning of your book when you get assigned to write this piece on middle-aged men not having any friends. And you're like, hey, why me? But you really embraced it, and it sent you on quite a journey.
Well, first, I'd try to talk myself out of it, you know, to try to justify why I wasn't perfect for it. And the more I thought about it, I was all too perfect for it. And mostly because I had a typical story. You know, I thought I was checking off all the important boxes with job and family and kids and what are we having for dinner. But, you know, each day I wasn't really doing anything for my friendships.
You know, obviously the pandemic has made it harder, but you really lay out that this friendship crisis or crisis in friendship wasn't just for you and really was unfolding for people sort of in the middle of life long before COVID-19. What did you learn?
Well, it's getting progressively worse. I mean, in terms of the way we measure it, and I would have never thought I was part of the problem. I mean, Vivek Murthy, who was the Surgeon General at the time I went on this little journey or began this journey, this was his chief platform. He was going around everywhere spouting about how loneliness kills, how dangerous this was, how it can affect not just our mental health, but our physical health. And I'm not sure I would have been ready to handle it or to listen to it or to raise my hand and acknowledge it might be a part of it. But I got conned into this assignment by an editor, and I took it on, and I realized I was indeed perfect for it. And the data is there. We're getting worse. It's terrible. I mean, the health consequences are almost unbelievably bad. I still find it hard to believe this idea that if you don't want to see the doctor, see your friends. But The question then became like, all right, we've identified the cancer, like what's the cure and how do we go about doing it? And it, I mean, anyone that's tried to make friends or, you know, try to reach out to OFA, it's a weirdly awkward process that really means you have to be vulnerable. And especially for men, that's just not something we're programmed to feel comfortable doing.
So let's pick up on that. And I know a lot of readers over the years since you started this project have reached out to you, wanted to engage on this. Our callers are calling in. So let's go to the phones. 800-423-8255. We've got Ian on the line from Dorchester. Ian, you're on with Billy Baker. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for having me. I just wanted to ask about whether or not you go into detail in regards to men of the older generation's inability to process their emotions properly, right? So a lot of older folks that I know, they tend to just kind of react aggressively or mad when things happen and go wrong. And so in friendships, you know, that can be pretty tumultuous, I think.
Thanks for the call, Ian. Billy?
Yeah, I don't think it's exclusive to older guys. Each person's an individual, but, you know, I do talk quite a bit about sort of all the aspects of friendship in the book, and one of them is fight or flight, which is something that is how men react to stress. And we either take off or we can be, a jerk ready to throw hands. And there's a fundamental difference where when stress comes for women, they do something that is known as tend and befriend. So there's a lot to learn from how women react to stress as opposed to men. So yes, I do think it's easy to get aggressive and defensive rather than than giving in to the sort of emotional moment.
You know, you touch in the book on masculinity in friendship, femininity in friendship, but you spend a lot of time on a word you used a couple of minutes ago, which is vulnerability. And we've put for you a passage for you to read about a grand gesture of going to an airport to save a relationship that I think speaks to that vulnerability a little. Would you read it for us?
Sure. If I'm honest, I must admit that I'm a sucker for those scenes in movies where the guy races off to the airport to save a relationship. They're all the same, but damn if they don't all work. There is the frantic cab ride, the throwing of the money at the driver, the dash into the terminal searching for the departures board, the scanning of the flight numbers, the zoom in on the words final boarding, and then the run. I love the run. The tracking shot, the swelling music, the complete disregard for the fact that you haven't been able to do any of these things in an airport since 9/11. The hero bobbing and weaving his way through the crowds, hurtling children in wheelie bags. Cut to the gate agent who is announcing the final boarding call. The hero is full on sprinting now as more children in wheelie bags appear in his path. Now the woman is at the jetway, taking one last forlorn look over her shoulder, pondering, before hesitantly handing over her ticket. And wait! And now I was ready to do all of this for a buddy.
Exactly. A buddy who had moved to Vienna. Tell us a little bit more about that.
So I wrote this article for The Globe about how guys stunk a friendship. And in it, I mentioned my two best friends from high school. And as soon as the article came out, I emailed it to them. And one of them replied and said, I totally agree with everything you're saying, which is why what I'm about to tell you is not going to go over well. But I neglected to mention that I moved to Vienna in Austria.
Oh, by the way.
Yeah. It happens, right? Like it shouldn't have, but we'd lost contact just enough where before leaving town, I just wasn't on the list of things to do. And we were both to blame. And so to try and save it, I did this, what's ultimately a romantic gesture to chase him to the other side of the world, to try and save something that was important to both of us and to acknowledge it was important to both of us.
And tell our listeners, did you save it?
I did, yeah. To some extent, he's now missing again, but we reconnected. And now he's living in an Airstream trailer somewhere near the Grand Canyon. So we're not hanging out on a daily basis, but I think our friendship is stronger than ever.
Besides, it sounds like maybe part of him just likes to go missing a little, and you can't really take responsibility for that.
That's a thing, yes. We call that pulling a Rory, and he's very good at it.
Let's go back to the phones, 800-423-8255. We've got Natalie on the line in Revere. Natalie, go ahead.
Hi, I just want to say I can't speak to the male aspect of this, but me and my friends, two of whom are male, but they're gay best friend since high school, and we've all been friends for the last 22 years. We keep on a group text that we all check in with pretty much multiple times weekly. We haven't been able to see each other, obviously, through this crazy times as much as we'd like to, but we had a couple of friendly COVID meetups. And if I didn't have them, I wouldn't have gotten through, you know, the tough times in my life. And, you know, what's most important to me is my relationships with them. And I just hope people can still find a way to connect and share the things with the people that they love.
Thanks, Natalie. Billy, let me let you react to that.
I mean, isn't it the best thing in the world? Like, this is a conversation. It's two conversations, right? We talk about loneliness, and that word just kind of clears the room, right? It's something we're not super comfortable talking about. And so I started with an assignment in loneliness, but then I went on a journey in friendship. And isn't that like one of the happiest, warmest words we have? And just listen to her talk about this crew of friends that means so much. These are the important things in life. And I, if I was guilty of anything, it was not prioritizing that. It was ranking it as something I did after the important stuff was done. And that stuff is never done.
You know, Julie just now talked about the fact that she checks in with her friends weekly, and that made me think of Wednesday nights in the book. Can you talk a little bit about Wednesday nights?
So Wednesday night was an idea I stole from a man I'd met, an older guy in the town I live in. I live on the North Shore in Essex, and he had mentioned one day that he had this crew that got together on Wednesday nights. They've been doing it for decades, and it sounded sort of cute. And then when I started on this journey, it was like, I think that's what I need ultimately. And I originally, what's chronicled in this book is this kind of comic adventure. And much of the beginning of the book is me going through the relationships of my past. And ultimately what I realized is that if I really wanted to get the benefits of friendship, I needed it to be part of my daily life. So I basically set out to build a new squad in the present. And so I took this Wednesday night idea. I found a guy who was willing to let us use his barn on Wednesday nights. And then I invited a dozen guys and said, basically, do you want to join my middle-aged dad fraternity where we hang out on Wednesday nights? And I don't know what we're going to do, but it has worked. And we are talking on a Thursday. And I spent Wednesday night, last night, around a campfire with 10 guys who it was sort of a pseudo book launch party for them. But they spent basically 2 hours making fun of me. And it was great.
10. And this, it's been a couple years now that you've been doing Wednesday nights.
It's been about 2 years. And, we don't get 10 every time, but right now with COVID, these grand questions of like, how do we connect? We've been gathering around the fire, which is so primal and simple. And yet I can't tell you what we do. I can tell you that we haven't forgotten how to be juveniles. You know, I mean, we're all 40 something guys who are wondering how high we can make the fire before someone calls 911 on us, you know. But it's like, you know, thankfully one of the guys is a firefighter, but it's so simple. It's such a simple pleasure. And it's not like we get to deep topics all the time, but if we need to get deep or you really need someone, you know, to have your back, like I feel like I now have them. And that was something that was missing from my life before all of this.
Billy, let's pick up one more call. Robert's on the line from Lexington. Robert, you're on with Billy Baker.
Great segue. Every Wednesday night for about 30 years, I've been running a discussion group, and the Facebook page is Deep Thoughts Lex, as in Lexington. And every Wednesday now, because of COVID, we're meeting with a different Deep Thoughts topic. Last night, we talked about emotions and mental health. We discussed sex or utopia or next week it's on police and law enforcement, and the Facebook page is Deep Thoughts Lex, as in Lexington. It is free. It is every single Wednesday night on Zoom. And I've been running this for 30 years. Yes.
Thank you, Robert. And there's Robert, Billy, being a little vulnerable, right? Inviting people into his circle, into his community. You talk a lot. There are several vignettes in this book about the moments where you had to choose to be vulnerable and say to someone else, basically, will you be my friend or will you still be my friend?
Oh, so awkward. Is it? I mean, just hearing you say that, I can feel the, and you know what? Every time it worked. You know, being a little bit vulnerable, showing intent, reaching out. Like, I mean, I'm not the only person who needs someone to hang out with on a Wednesday night. And so it was easier than I thought it was going to be in my head. That doesn't mean there weren't some dumpster fire ideas that I threw at the wall and didn't stick, but it was, you know, I tried, people responded, and ultimately, you know, I don't know, my friends from the past, I'm more actively friends with them, and I have new friends in the present. It's been... would I have done any of this had I not been forced by an assignment or the idea that I was going to write a book? Like, I'm not sure, but I'm thankful that I did.
You know, I was thinking about the fact that we're in a pandemic. You had 10 people, but they were outdoors and it was only 10, which is sort of the max that we can do. I think it's actually 25 outdoors, 10 indoors. But our concepts of gathering are now kind of regulated and we are so lonely. And in fact, what keeps us physically healthy is staying apart. What can people do now in this pandemic to keep those friendships alive and to keep from being lonely and keep nurturing those relationships?
I mean, it's the same things pre-pandemic, and it's sometimes the simplest things. Like, it took me a while to figure out what it was and what I was trying to say, but I came up with this term I call velvet hooks. And you just need to find that thing that's soft. It's not like overly committal, but we know what they are, right? Like, they're the book clubs and the fantasy football leagues and the bowling nights and the, you know, whatever it might be. They've been going on forever. COVID has obviously put a damper on some of those, but they're still out there. They're still available. I mean, I have a Wednesday night crew that we sit around a campfire. You know, there's, you know, that monthly walk you might take, whatever it might be. Obviously, you know, outdoors is a safer way to do this. But, you know, I think, you know, when this first started, there were all these Zoom reunions. And I think we might be a little bit burnt out on another Zoom invitation at this point. I think everyone's desperate for, you know, certainly here in Massachusetts, for the weather to warm up again and to be able to hang out outside with our friends. But it, you know, it just takes, you know, finding a way to be friends with your friends, you know, finding whatever that velvet hook is for you, for a group, for each individual, and then, you know, sticking with it, you know, having something in experts will tell you that the best thing is something that's regularly on the calendar, because then life works around it. If you try
Wednesdays.
To schedule every time, it gets tricky.
All right. That is Billy Baker, a reporter from the Boston Globe who does his Wednesday nights, and his new memoir is We Need to Hang Out. Billy Baker, that was fun. Thanks so much for joining us.
That was fun. Thank you.
And that is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Thanks for listening. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us tomorrow for Radio Boston's Week in Review.